next, Tuesday's briefing at the U.S. State Department.
So it's nice to be back with you all. I'd first thank you.
Everything is okay.
First, you all were so so kind and thoughtful. Many of you sent me emails and text messages asking about my family, and I just want to say a heartfelt thanks to all of you for that. I really appreciated that. And to my colleagues who were also so kind and did so much. It's just away for a week, but nevertheless, a lot happens in the world when you're away. So I'd like to thank my colleagues, especially our Undersecretary for Public Affairs and Public Diplomacy, Steve Goldstein, who came out here in front of all of you, which is not really always a fun job, but he did it nonetheless. So I want to say thank you to Undersecretary Goldstein for having done that. So so I'm back with you.
I'm going to take exception. What do you mean it's not always a fun thing?
Well, it's difficult. Sometimes a hospital stay might be more fun than briefing. But
wow.
But I knew it was time to come back to work when my son was, Mommy, go back to Washington. So thanks again to all of you. Let's start out today with a little bit about the Secretary's travel. As many of you know, the Secretary is in Vancouver today as co-host of the Vancouver Foreign Minister's Meeting on Security and Stability in the Korean Peninsula with the Canadian Foreign Minister, Chrystia Freeland. The meeting is to bring together nations from across the globe to demonstrate international solidarity against North Korea's dangerous and illegal nuclear and ballistic missile programs. Discussions will focus on advancing and strengthening diplomatic efforts toward a secure, prosperous, and denuclearized Korean Peninsula. U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis was also at the ministerial welcome dinner last evening. Secretary Tillerson will hold a press conference later today. I believe it'll be about 8 p.m. Eastern time, so we will be sure to bring you information on that, but you can certainly watch it as well. In addition to that, today is Religious Freedom Day. Today marks 232 years since the enactment of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which served as the model for protecting religious liberty that was later enshrined in our First Amendment to the Constitution. The religious freedom we take for granted here at home is under serious attack throughout the world. In Burma, Rohingya have been the victims of ethnic cleansing at the hands of Burmese security forces and also local vigilantes. Across South Asia, members of religious minorities experience societal discrimination and violence, which is exacerbated by laws and policies that punish speech, restrict religious conversions, or ban certain beliefs. Protecting and promoting religious freedom is a priority of this Trump administration. In the Middle East, we're taking firm steps to defeat ISIS while we work with members of affected religious minorities to restore their communities, their religious freedom, and their way of life. We've enhanced our cooperation with like-minded governments around the world to combat the actions of abusive regimes and promote respect and understanding across religious lines in divided societies. Together with our partners both at home and abroad, we will strive for a world where we can all enjoy the freedoms of thought, freedoms of conscience, and freedoms of religion. And finally, I want to note something that happened yesterday in Baghdad. Lori, I know this is something that you're watching very carefully. And I want to just make it clear that we condemned in the strongest possible terms Monday's barbaric attack in Tahrir Square in Baghdad. The brutal attacks on innocent civilians demonstrates once again the savagery of the enemy that we face there. We want to extend our deepest condolences to the family of the victims and hope for a speedy recovery of those wounded. Those attacks are an awful reminder that despite having liberated Iraqi territory from ISIS, terrorism remains a threat there. The U.S. government reaffirms its commitment to support the government and the people of Iraq in their efforts to ensure an enduring defeat of ISIS and also its ideology. With that, I'd be happy to take your questions today. Matt,
thanks.
Would you like to start?
And welcome back. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Let's start with in the Mideast with the Palestinians.
Okay.
Today, you guys informed the UN Relief and Works Agency that you're going to be withholding $65 million in a $125 million tranche, the first one of this calendar year. And I'm just wondering if you could explain exactly why you're doing this.
Mm-hmm. So let me start by saying that we delivered a letter today to UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, UNRWA. We committed a voluntary contribution of $60 million for 2018 so far. This will be divided into tranches. $60 million is what we have indicated as the first available tranche. That money is going to sustain schools and health services to ensure that teachers and also healthcare providers can be paid their salaries. One of the reasons we decided to do this is that we felt that not providing that money would run the risk of having the organization and the people there run out of funds, and that those entities would have to be potentially closed down. You bring up an additional pot of money, and that's also $2018, $65 million. That is money that will be held for future consideration. It's money that's being frozen at this time. It's not being canceled. It's just being held for future consideration. One of the things that the United States would like to do is see some revisions made in how UNRWA operates. One of our bureaus, PRM, one of our bureaus here at the State Department, has a formal oversight role with UNRWA. We have people on the ground who take a look at some of the UNRWA activities and things they do, how the money is being spent. And one of the things this administration would like to do, just as we talk about UN reform, is take a look at UNRWA, trying to make sure that the money is best spent and best spent so that people can get the services, whether it's school or the healthcare services that they need.
What does it have to do to get the other $65 million, or is it pretty much a lost cause?
It's not a lost cause at all. We would like to see some reforms being made. You'll want to know the specifics. I'm not going to get into the specifics of that today, but we're taking a look at the organization, we're monitoring it, and we'd like to see some reforms be made.
Is this a response to the Palestinians bringing the UN General Assembly resolution to a vote? I mean, is this, I guess there's been a lot of criticism of plans to do this, which are, by people who say that this is all mm-hmm. political. That this doesn't really have to do with reforms, that this is aimed at punishing the Palestinians for them.
This is not aimed at punishing anyone. The United States government and the Trump administration believe that there should be more so-called burden sharing to go around. The United States has been in the past the largest single donor to UNRWA. We would like other countries, in fact, other countries that criticize the United States for what they believe to be our position vis-a-vis the Palestinians, other countries that have criticized us, to step forward and actually help with UNRWA to do more. So we're asking other countries to do more, just as we have with NATO, asking other countries to provide that 2% GDP into its defense. We are asking countries to do more as it pertains to UNRWA.
All right, I'll let others after this. This is my last one. So when you say you're asking other countries to step up, have you actually asked other countries to step up?
I believe
or is it up to UNRWA to go and put out their hat to the Europeans, to whoever?
Well, I think just based on the way that the United States has operated in the past, where we've put pressure on other countries, we've had conversations with other countries asking them to do more. I can't imagine that we would handle this any differently.
No, I guess my point is, if in fact it is not a punishment or a political move to withhold this money, it seems to me that you would, and in fact, it's only about redistributing the how UNRWA gets its money so that the United States pays less. It would seem to me that you guys would be out beating down people's doors saying, hey, we're withholding $65 million, make this up, or you should.
What we do as a government, and you don't hear us very often call out other countries specifically to do more. Sometimes we do that, but other times we find that we can be more effective and get countries to do more in whatever area we're looking for them to do more when we have some of those private conversations. But I can assure you, as a part of our policy, we will be going to different countries and we will ask them to step up to the plate and provide additional money. Again, today announcing the $60 million that's going, the $65 million and a potential second tranche is being held for now. And when I have more for you on that, I'll certainly give it
to you.
Decision in any way related to the president's January 2nd tweet,
yes,
in which he said that the United States has given the Palestinians hundreds of millions of dollars but has gotten no appreciation or respect, and in which he then said, with their not being interested in peace negotiations, why should the United States keep giving this money?
Look, I don't know that I don't have the president's tweet right in front of me, so I'd have to refer you back to the White House
on
that one.
I can quote it to
you. Okay, but as a general matter, we will look for other countries to do more to help out. We don't believe that taking care of other nations and other people has to solely be the United States' responsibility. People want that to be our responsibility. We're very generous. In fact, I would argue we're the most generous nation on the globe, but we will ask other countries to do more.
That's not my question. I mean, the president made pretty clear in that tweet that his concern was not getting appreciation or respect from the Palestinians, and saying the Palestinians weren't interested in peace talks. And I'm just asking, do those two factors, a lack of appreciation and respect and a Palestinian unwillingness to engage in peace talks, underlie or factor in any way to this decision?
Arshad, I can tell you we're not giving up on peace talks. We're not giving up on those conversations. It's something very important to this administration. Secretary Tillerson ultimately made this decision in consultation with other members of the administration. But that's where things landed.
What can you say whether, I mean, the president is the ultimate policymaker. Okay. You know, he a couple of weeks ago said that he wanted to, you know, cut aid to the Pakistanis. He went ahead and did that. He made clear that he was reconsidering aid to the Palestinians, and I'm just asking, and it seems reasonable.
I'm not certain if this is what the president was referring to or not. I just have to refer you to the White House. I've not spoken to the president about this issue. So I'm sorry, I don't have the information to be able to answer that question. Okay, perhaps the White House can.
So you're saying that there's absolutely no connection between the political stance or the refusal of the Palestinian Authority to enter into negotiations, which are not there. I mean, there are no negotiations going on to which they have been invited to, and they turned it down. But you're saying that cutting off aid to UNRWA has nothing to do with the political situation.
I can tell you that it has long been a concern of this administration, a year into the administration, about UNRWA and how it handles itself and how it manages its money. Right. And that is part of the reason why we would have a bureau, our Population Refugees and Migration, PRM, that it plays a role in oversight, not management, but oversight of these types of funding mechanisms. That's nothing new. It's been around for a long time.
Okay, so it is just purely management and organization. It has nothing to do with
it. That is my understanding.
That is your understanding. But, you know, UNRWA provides these services in terms of clinics, schools, and, you know, doesn't give money to the Palestinians, give them food and medical care and provides school. They're already very strapped. So I wonder how you would, let's say, handle the humanitarian situation that will result from the cutting off of 52% of the budget.
Okay, I don't have the percentage in front of me, but I know that the United States will be asking other nations around the world, including Arab nations and others, to kick in money. Some of those countries do not provide any of the money at this time. So those countries, we would ask for them to pay into it as well.
So it has nothing to do with the, you know, historical Israeli demand or Netanyahu's statement last week that UNRWA needs to just disappear from the face of the earth because it has perpetuated the Palestinian.
I'm sorry, I did not see that statement by the Prime Minister.
Okay, I just have a couple more. But did you submit a list of what UNRWA should be doing to keep that, you know, that fund flowing? Did you submit that to them?
I'm not aware of that, but some of these conversations will be ongoing. We delivered a letter to UNRWA today just announcing the $60 million, and the conversations will be ongoing.
Because UNRWA always claims that whatever reforms you want them to do, they have done in the past, and they discussed these issues with you directly. So, but this time around, there seems to have been no list saying that we want you to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I'm not aware of that. I will look into it to see if we gave them a list of specific things that we are asking them to do. But our main point today is asking other countries to step up to the plate, not making the United States be the single largest donor or the sole donor, and other countries to step in and do more.
So okay? It is a sharing of responsibilities and has nothing to do with the political reality.
Look, that is my understanding, yes.
Hi,
Dave.
The Israeli ambassadors welcomed your decision, saying that it's punishment for UNRWA's political position. Is he incorrect?
Those are his words. I have not seen that myself. I've not seen that word that you just mentioned, so I'm not going to characterize or comment on that.
Okay.
Let's move on to something else.
Well, I just have one more on this. As you are aware, there was disagreement within the top levels of the administration about this decision, and a lot of concern expressed by from this building, but also from the Pentagon and intel agencies about the impact that a severe reduction in U.S. funding to UNRWA would have on stability in the region, particularly in Jordan and Lebanon. So my question is, have you been in touch with the Egyptians, with the Lebanese, with the Jordanians about this decision? You know, the vice president is going to be going to the region very soon. There are even some in Israel who are not convinced that this is that significant reductions in this assistance is a good idea. Has there been contact with those?
The secretary has had a big list of calls that he's gone through over the past few days, over the past 10 days or so, certainly since I've been out, on many issues. I know he's spoken with the Jordanians. I know he's spoken with others in the region. I haven't had a chance to go through some of those calls just yet. Your first part of your question was what, Matt? I'm sorry, I have an answer to it, and I just forgot what you had asked initially.
Thank you.
So in terms of instability, one of the questions that people had asked about 10 days, 2 weeks or so ago was, you know, will you zero out this money? Remember that whole flurry of reporting went around, people thinking that the United States would cancel out the money altogether. Look, a big part of the reason we didn't, after a lot of interagency deliberations, was we thought that that would have a negative impact. So here's where we came down. $60 million today, a potential second tranche, $65 million, and potentially more in the future. So we took those concerns into consideration. I want to note to you, the number didn't end up being zero. Today it ended up being $60 million. So we're somewhere. Okay?
Thanks.
Flory, you want to talk about Iraq?
Yes. Okay. You mentioned the secretary's phone calls, and one of them yesterday was with the Prime Minister Barzani. Would you have a readout on that?
I don't have a readout of that call, but I can tell you that the secretary spoke with both Prime Minister Abadi. He also spoke with Mr. Barzani as well. This was yesterday. When he spoke with the Prime Minister Abadi, I know he expressed his condolences for the suicide bombing, the homicide bombing that took place in Baghdad. I can tell you this, that I know that based on those calls, that we are optimistic that KRG and also the government of Baghdad we'll be having more conversations in the future.
You say a number of countries, including Iran and Russia, have offered to mediate between Erbil and Baghdad. Are you prepared to make a similar offer?
Lori, we have long said that we would be happy to sit down and help facilitate those conversations and meetings if we are asked to do so. We believe that the governments can do that on their own. We have seen this as they have started to have some face-to-face meetings. We think that's moving in the right direction.
And on the Iraqi elections that are coming up, the prime minister formed a briefly lived alliance, lasts about 2 days, with the pro-Iranian militia leaders to run in the elections. Did that bother you?
I missed that then, if it only lasted 2 days. Where do we want to go next?
Go.
Yes, hi, Jenny, how are you?
Hi. Thank you, nice to see you. North Korea, recently North Korean government said that nuclear issue will not put negotiation on the table, negotiation table. So what do U.S. expect to talk with North Korea without the negotiation about nuclear issues?
Well, we don't have any conversations that aren't going with North Korea. So I'm not exactly sure what you mean. Now is not the time. Our policy hasn't changed. Now is not the time to sit down and have talks with North Korea. At some point, if and when they're willing to be serious about the issue of denuclearization, we would be happy to entertain that, but we're nowhere near that point yet.
But it seems like they just talked for the talks, but not putting any nuclear issues put on the table.
Well, look, I think it's pretty fresh that the Republic of Korea and also the DPRK are having conversations. We just saw the second one take place yesterday pertaining to the Olympics, and I think that's a good sign. And it's an excellent sign that the United States, with 20-plus countries, are up in Vancouver right now. We are exploring additional ways to enhance our maximum pressure campaign. We've seen that campaign be successful. We know, and as has the Republic of Korea's Mr. Moon has indicated this as well, without that maximum pressure campaign that so many countries have been involved with, North Korea would not be having talks with South Korea. Granted, limited to the issue of the Olympics, but that is a start. So today, one of the things that the secretary is doing is having a lot of conversations with those countries about how we can better enhance the maximum pressure campaign to get North Korea to denuclearize. An important thing for us, and I think it's an important sign that so many countries were present to show up to see what they can do to better help. Okay, hey, Nicole. Let's stay on DPRK for now. Yeah. Okay.
So we're almost year into President Trump's tenure, and arguably the most pressing foreign policy challenge he's had has been North Korea, and yet we still don't have an ambassador in South Korea. Mm-hmm. Why not, and what can you say about that?
Yeah, you know, this is something that we've covered before. We have a chargé d'affaires in South Korea, Mark Knapper. Mark is a longtime foreign service officer. He's beloved by many people in this administration and also at the State Department. He's been to North Korea numerous times. He speaks quite a few of the languages of South, you know, that part of the world. And so we are confident that our embassy there is in good hands. It is ultimately up to the White House to determine the nominations for any post. You all know that. I know that the Secretary and the Administrator and the White House are working hard to determine more people, more qualified candidates to take those positions. I can't get out of the White House and announce anything, but I can tell you we are in good hands. When I talk to any of my colleagues here, because certainly I've asked the same question, you know, why don't we have this? Why don't we have somebody there? And folks love Mark Knapper. I've spoken to him myself, or at least have emailed with him, and I'm confident he's doing a great job. Anything else related to
Yeah, Asia? You'll be okay. Yeah. Just on the format of today's talk, so obviously the Chinese and the Russians have denounced this body that's meeting in Vancouver as a Cold War throwback. They're based on the countries that fought China as well as North Korea between 50 and 53. If you're trying to maintain an international front, total solidarity for the maximum pressure campaign, is it not just a mistake image-wise to meet with the people who went to war against China?
You know, I think Russia and China can call it whatever they want to call it. It is clear, and the bottom line with that is both of those nations signed on to three unanimous UN Security Council resolutions. Both China and Russia share our objectives, and that is the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. They do not want to see Kim Jong-un develop a nuclear weapon any more than the United States or any other country does, for that matter. So we are all on the same page. They're not at the meeting, and that's okay. They can call it whatever they want.
Can I go back to the Palestinians just for one second?
Let's come back to let's finish up Asia, and then we can come back to the Palestinian thing.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
It's not that. It's a different.
Okay, go ahead, sir. Hi.
Thank you. Nice to have you back.
Thank you.
So last week, Steve said that the United States has been in touch with China and Russia regarding the Vancouver meeting. Is President Trump's phone call with President Xi Jinping yesterday a part of this touch, considering the timing of the phone call?
Yeah, I think that would certainly be considered part of it. Among the things that the president spoke with President Xi about was talking about the hope that they might prompt a change in the behavior of the DPRK. We consider it to be destructive behavior. They consider it to be destructive behavior. President Trump committed to sustain the United States-led global campaign of maximum pressure to compel North Korea to commit to denuclearization. So I think that that is a part of our ongoing conversations.
And did they talk about this Vancouver meeting specifically?
The White House provided a readout of that phone call, so I just have to refer you to the White House for that readout. Okay? Okay. Anything else related to DPRK, Japan? Go ahead. Right ahead. Hi. Thank you.
Just about Iran, I think President Trump's announcement last Friday didn't make it quite clear that did President Trump again decertified about Iran's compliance with the treaty.
Okay, so we're moving on to Iran. Did anybody else have any other questions related to DPRK? Anything related to that? Okay. We'll come back to that then, sir. Okay. So to your question about Iran and the president. As you know, the president extended the waivers on some of the sanctions for another 120 days. That's to provide time for the administration, in conjunction with members of Congress, to come up with legislative language to work harder on legislation that would help try to pull Iran into better compliance and look to being tougher on Iran. So that is something that the administration decided. Some of those conversations, from what I have been told, between Congress and the administration, they're making some pretty good progress on the legislation and some of the language on that.
But I think also just every 90 days, president is supposed to notify Congress that whether Iran is just in compliance mm-hmm. with the treaty or not. So the January 15th is supposed to be the latest deadline. So is there any decisions? So
I'm not sure that today is
15th.
If that's
actually
is that correct?
Monday.
But that was the announcement that the president made on Friday.
I think these are two different things. It's like
let me get back to you on that. Okay. Okay. Thank you. Okay. What do we?
Briefly, because I have a feeling that you're not going to have an answer, but I just need.
I love how you always say that. You know, I have a feeling you're not going to have an answer as you look down your nose.
You're going to say, I think I'm going to predict your answer. Mm-hmm. We're not going to comment on every time another leader makes some crazy remark, some remark. That's my prediction.
Okay, you might be right, Matt.
Okay, so this is a Palestinian. So you're probably aware that Palestinian Authority President Abbas gave a very, very critical, harsh speech about this administration,
yes,
about the president, and about, in fact, other Arabs. I'm wondering what your response to that speech is.
I think in listening to that speech, and you're right about that, but, you know, I can say clearly emotions are running high. Emotions are running high in the region, and we certainly accept that. I'd like to caution folks in the region and Mr. Abbas that some of those words, some of the things they're saying would be considered inflammatory, and they might in fact be unhelpful and divisive. We would like to see a peace process go forward. We've talked about that a lot. That's something that's important to this administration. But we know the tensions and emotions are running high. We would just caution them on some of the language, because we'd like to see both sides be able to come to the table and talk.
Okay, and just to put a very fine point on it, this decision on UNRWA today is completely mm-hmm. unrelated to that speech.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Okay. All right. Let's move on to something else. Let's move
on
to something
else. Sorry.
Okay.
The Turkish military began shelling Kurdish positions in Afrin province in northern Syria. What is the U.S. position as its NATO ally is shelling its number one ally in the fight against ISIS in Syria?
Okay. I'm afraid I don't have anything for you on that.
Okay. Wait,
I don't have a specific report on whether or not we can confirm that that is taking place.
Okay, well, okay. Along the same lines, there's also been the announcement of a border force consisting primarily of Kurdish militias allied with the U.S. in the SDF along the Syrian-Turkish border. And President Erdogan called it a terror army and said he would strangle it before it's born. So, you know, this is another place where there's kind of a contradiction between two U.S. allies. So yeah. I'm just wondering if the U.S. has a position on this.
Well, Turkey is a very important and valued NATO ally. We have a lot of interactions with the Turkish government. As you probably know, the foreign minister of Turkey is in Vancouver right now, where I believe he will be meeting or have some sort of a chat with Secretary Tillerson, or at least some of our representatives later today. So an important NATO ally. In terms of what is going on in Syria, the United States is in Syria to defeat ISIS. Any activities that we take part in with regard to the Syrian Democratic Forces is something that's internal only to Syria. And I say that because it is important that we defeat ISIS, that we make sure, and when I say we, I say that not just on behalf of the United States, but the entire coalition, the 72 or 73 member coalition, the importance of not letting ISIS take root the way that they had before and further destabilize that country. So that what the United States is involved with regard to the Syrian Democratic Forces, or the SDF, is that to defeat ISIS. That is solely what it is for, the internal purposes of defeating ISIS.
But if Turkey does indeed attack the border force,
I'm not going to get into any kind of hypothetical like that. Okay? Thank you.
The independent group Freedom House today released its rankings on world democracy, and Turkey has been downgraded. They're no longer considered a free country, according to this report. Does the United States government regard Turkey as a democracy?
Yeah, I would say we're certainly aware of the Freedom House report. We have said this for a long time, that we're very concerned about some of the activities taking place in Turkey. We're concerned about the pattern of actions by Turkish officials clamping down on freedom of speech. Ilhan, you and I have had a lot of conversations certainly about that. And the Turkish government's activities in which it appears to target people whose views differ from that of the government. So that is something that we watch very carefully. Okay.
Syria.
Okay.
Syria.
Okay. Lori, go ahead.
Last week, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing, Assistant Secretary of State David Satterfield explained that if the Geneva talks didn't work out, then the U.S. had a fallback plan to retain forces in Syria, which this SDF border force seems to be a part of. And he gave two other purposes, because ISIS will be defeated soon. He said to count to be an alternative to the Syrian regime, alternative kind of government, so Syrians could see what a better life is like, and to counter Iran. So he was suggesting that the U.S. presence in Syria was going to be a shift in mission. Was presumably he knows what he's talking about, no?
You know, I can tell you that our sole purpose for being in Syria has been the defeat of ISIS. Certainly, are there concerns about Iran's malign activity around the world, in particular in that part of the world? Of course there are. It's not just the United States that shares concerns about Iran's malign activities. Other countries do as well. But the main reason we are in Syria is for the defeat of ISIS.
Do you think that could shift in the future?
I'm not going to get ahead of any policy positions of the U.S. government on that. Where we are right now is we are there to defeat ISIS, and we also support a political transition. We've talked about that, the Geneva talks, and having the ability to have the Syrian people decide for themselves what kind of government they would like.
Cuba, please. Okay. During the President Obama's administration, there were visas granted for 5 years to intellectuals, artists, musicians, and some of these visas are starting to expire. Will these intellectuals and musicians be able to go online and access the, or must they also travel?
I'm afraid I don't have any information on the musicians and artists visa applications. Many of you know that the visa process is something that we keep a very close hold on. We consider that to be confidential as it pertains to individuals. I can take a look and see, as a general matter, what we might be doing about those special types of visas and see if I can get you an answer for that.
And also, now that the Cuban citizens have to go to Colombia to get their visas through the American embassy there in Bogota, has the U.S. government contacted or had any contact with Colombia to assist in this process, because Cuban citizens now require visas to go into Colombia?
I can certainly ask our experts on that and see if I can get you an answer.
Thank you.
Okay. Kylie, hi. Anything else on Cuba?
Pakistan, please.
Okay.
So the Bangladesh government says that it plans to repatriate all Rohingya refugees within 2 years. And so I'm just wondering if the U.S. supports that decision and where you guys stand on contact with the Burmese government right now.
Yeah. So I certainly saw that report that they plan to repatriate all of the Rohingya refugees, they say, within 2 years. The most important part of that would be the safe and voluntary, respectful return of those people. If it cannot take place in 2 years, let me back up. The timeline is less important to us than the ability for people to safely and voluntarily go home when it is safe to do so. We don't want people to be pushed back into their homes or their communities when they don't feel that it's safe. That's completely counterproductive. They don't want that. We don't want that. The nations don't necessarily want that either. So it has to be safe and voluntary.
And do you believe it's safe right now for them to start that process?
I don't have a ground assessment update for you, but it is such a short period of time between when those people were forced to leave their homes and now. I mean, it's only been several months. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that anyone would feel safe at this point in returning to their homes. I mean, based on my conversations with people when I spent a short period of time in Burma and also in Bangladesh about how those refugees felt, they were no place to be able to go back home. I mean, many of the people mm-hmm. I saw there were extremely frail and very, very scared.
And one quick follow-up on that. Tillerson has said that those who are responsible for this violence should be held accountable. Does the U.S. See any of that accountability actually happening yet? I mean, is there?
Well, you may recall we had some sanctions that had been put in place a few weeks ago against I believe it was a military general from Burma. It's something that we're carefully watching. We continue to watch that as we continue to watch the case of the Reuters reporters who are being held there. I also saw, interesting to note, that former UN Ambassador Bill Richardson may be helping to facilitate their release. We certainly wish him well. He's not operating under the State Department in that capacity to try to work with the government there of Myanmar to get their release, but we certainly hope that he will be successful in doing that. He has been successful in that in the past, and so we're hoping that he has some good luck in releasing those reporters. One of the most important things for a country and for a country to flourish is to be able to have an open marketplace of ideas, freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and for reporters to be able to do their jobs.
While you were away last week, you may have heard that the president, in a meeting with some congressional leaders and others about immigration reform, made a comment that's been variously described, but agreed to, I think, by everyone, most people involved at least, that it was a vulgarity, which has created anger around the world. We know of a handful of U.S. ambassadors or chargés, ranking members of embassies, who have been summoned to various foreign ministries, particularly in Africa, mm-hmm. to hear protests and also presumably to be asked for an explanation of those comments. What, first of all, can you give us an update on the number of ambassadors or ranking diplomats at post who have been summoned around the world? And then secondly, can you tell us what the department has told these diplomats to say when they are confronted with officials, angry officials from mm-hmm. other governments?
You know, I can tell you, and I know that our Undersecretary for Public Affairs and Public Diplomacy, Steve Goldstein, addressed this with some of you last week. I believe it was here at this podium. We have a deep respect for people from the African continent. We have strong partnerships with the nearly 50 countries on the African continent. I will say this, which I say about other countries as well. Our relationships with countries are deeper than any one alleged comment. This president has been clear that he did not make that remark. You've had others in the room with the president who have said that they did not hear that remark. I wasn't there, so I can't provide you with a first-person account of that. In terms of our relationships with other countries, we have strong relationships. We have people, and I believe each one of the African countries working there on the ground on behalf of the State Department and on behalf of the American public. Our relationships are strong. We have great partnerships with many of these countries. We have a tremendous amount of respect for our African partners. You all may recall that Secretary Tillerson hosted, I believe it was 37 African nations at a ministerial meeting here. I believe it was in November. I can tell you Secretary Tillerson looks forward to visiting the African continent. It's just under 2 months from now. We don't have the specifics of that travel or where he will be visiting just yet, but that is something that's under discussion right now. Our Undersecretary for Political Affairs, Tom Shannon, will be visiting, and our Deputy Secretary recently visited about a month or so ago. So it's an important part of the world for us. We have important relationships there, and that hasn't changed.
What have you told your diplomats to tell countries that complain?
I'd have to refer you back to what Undersecretary Goldstein had provided to all of you. I just don't have that in front of me,
I'm
afraid.
Do you have an update on the number of diplomats who have been summoned to protests?
I do not.
Can you take that?
I will see what I can get for you, but I can tell you, you know, we have lots of conversations. Some are casual conversations. Some conversations are, are slightly more than casual conversations about these issues.
You may be misremembering this, but I think Undersecretary Goldstein gave us that in a fairly informal gaggle. So if you could get formal language.
I'll see what I can do for you. As you know, I wasn't here last week, so I'm afraid I just don't have the specifics of that.
Well, just one more on this. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, I'm curious if there are people in this building who are concerned that these reported comments have hurt the mission of the State Department, have hurt the standing of the United States abroad, particularly in Africa and potentially in Haiti.
Look, I'll go back to what I said a short while ago, and that is our relationship, our diplomatic relationships with countries all around the world
those relationships are stronger than any one alleged comment. Okay. And when you ask me about tweets, I will say again, our relationships with nations are stronger than any one tweet or alleged comment at any point.
That sounds
so people want to look at it as though it's just one small slice. We have a much broader relationship
with
these countries.
But it sounds as though you're saying just ignore this kind of thing.
Look.
Whether it's a tweet or a comment like this that has been
I'm just telling you, we have a strong relationship. We honor and value our partnerships with these nations. The secretary looks forward to traveling to the continent. We loved hosting the 37 or some nations who came here. So we have a valuable relationship.
And
I think those countries understand that as well.
But so you're saying that the leaders of other countries, officials of other countries, should pay no attention to what the President of the United States says.
Countries can pay attention however they choose to. I'm just telling you, from our point of view, our relationship is strong with nations. We continue to have conversations. We are active in their communities. We have people on the ground. We have probably thousands of people who work on behalf of the State Department in the many countries on the African continent. That work is very important to my colleagues and to this building, and that hasn't changed. I'm going to have to leave it there, guys.
Okay.
I'll take your question afterwards. I'll take your questions afterwards.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called Saudi Arabia and certain countries as traitors for their cooperation with the United States and Israel. Now, in this edition of the debate, we will discuss what types of cooperation the leader may be talking about. What is certain is that Iran's leader has said that unity in the Muslim world can lead to the defeat of any of the enemy's plots. Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, we have lecturer at the George Washington University, Nabil Mikhail, who joins us from Washington, D.C. And we have journalist and political commentator, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, who joins us from London. I'd like to welcome you both, and let me first start with you, Nabil Mikhail. We have Iran's leader who has slammed Islamic countries who are helping U.S. and Israel, calling them traitors. What Islamic countries may he be referring to, do you think?
Look, I mean, Iran has its own traditional enemies, so for sure he would be referring to the Gulf states, but frankly, I do not like this type of debate because, for one, it theologizes or it makes political debates like theology, and also it makes the whole question about foreign policy a black and white discussion. There are different interests. So even for the countries that are called pro-America, they still have differences with America. We do not know really what kind of foreign policy will be espoused by many countries in the year 2018 because of the nature of so many problems like Syria, like others. But I think the Middle East in general, or the Arab world in general, is adopting states' interests, whereby all these collective actions against a certain entity or an ideology is being discarded. So it's an Arab balance of power that is emerging, and we will find a process of alliance and counter-alliances formed instantly, and international politics in the Middle East could be in a state of flux.
Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, did you understand Nabil Mikhail there, who he was referring to? Because he was being very vague and he was talking in a very general sense. Put that into perspective for us, your understanding of what he said.
Well, I think it's very clear that Saudi Arabia and the alliance is built up.
Go ahead. Say that's Abbas.
Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, you have clearly United Arab Emirates, and Egypt. They've emerged as the foursome who are primarily working in the interests of the U.S. Obviously, they will say that they're working in their own geopolitical interests in the region, but the fact remains that these alliances have not just popped up from nowhere. They've been there for a very, very long time. The United States' primary goals in the region are what dictate how these four particularly operate. That there's no doubt. And alongside that, of course, is Israel. And the latest episode in the Middle East of actually declaring Jerusalem as a capital should give you a real hint, because Israel's alliance with the US becomes even clearer now that they're not really working in the interests of peace. They're working in the interests of one particular side, and that is Israel. The bottom line is that Saudi Arabia also has its entire system totally at the behest of the United States. In fact, they're defended by them, their military, their whole infrastructure. In the background, it's basically an Arab Zionism that actually exists in Saudi Arabia, and that's what they're leading. And the monarchs who rule over these nations are not in control of their countries, as far as I'm concerned. They are puppets, they are proxies, and they operate policies for those outsiders. And Palestine is the most critical area for us to look at, because ultimately the real cancer in that region is Israel. The fundamental cancer in the Middle East is Israel. That is what dictates the entire Middle Eastern policy as far as Western imperialism goes. And it's a sad fact that what Ayatollah Khamenei says is perfectly true. Those people who are operating in the interests of these foreign interests and in the interests of Israel, of course they're traitors.
Well, Nabil Mikhail, when I asked you the question about Iran's leader slamming Islamic countries who are helping the U.S. and Israel, calling them traitors, you said that you don't actually like that kind of debate. Right now, after the recognition of U.S. For Jerusalem, Al-Quds being Israel's capital, who's going to stand up for the Palestinians? We have heard words of condemnation coming out, but we heard that when the Gaza War happened, for example. But what did Arabs actually achieve in terms of going out and calling out the cause and standing behind it?
Good question. I think people who will help the Palestinians are many. First of all, or amongst the top, are the Palestinians themselves. Because even if Palestinian unity is elusive, the Palestinians can articulate a national interest, and they can advocate a certain agenda. And as we heard and saw from the recent meeting in Ramallah, that they are challenging America. We are not going to accept any initiative from America. That being said, is a big challenge, because for the past years, America would try to mediate, but whom will the Palestinians accept their mediation? I think the Palestinians are recognizing, after many losses, that there is an international consensus emerging, crystallized, consolidated, whatever you call it, that really supports the right for a state. So I think they will take real steps to basically implement that national plan. Israel will object, America will object, but again, the Palestinians do not need an American influence to achieve their state. So I think they can maintain at least the semblance of a state, and they can make it function. It will be an elevation over the Palestinian Authority, because the Palestinian Authority was beholden to peace projects that would be sketched by America and in consultation, even if on the facade, with quote-unquote the international community. So we're seeing now the reverse, is that the Palestinians are seeking the support of the international community, and there are many of them who are members of the international community, and they would like to lend a hand for the Palestinians to seek a state. And I'm glad that you mentioned Jerusalem. And let me just try to be brief, because I know that there are limits on time. Among those who voted for the Egyptian proposal at the General Assembly, asking for also, a recognition of Jerusalem for other religions and other nationalities, were Japan and South Korea. These two countries who are security partners for America. So the logic of a Palestinian state is actually inviting even the closest allies to America to disagree with it. So perhaps these two nations could be members of the international community who will endorse a Palestinian state.
Okay.
So the Palestinian actually can do well. They have to be organized and they have to be dedicated.
Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, do you think that finally there's an American president that is speaking his mind, and that could be taken as a positive thing because he is saying there are no rules, there's no international law, this is what I say, this is how I'm going to do it, and I'm talking about Donald Trump. And Palestinians, I'm going to dictate to you what you're going to get, which is, from what we understand, the so-called grand bargain to be not a bargain at all for Palestinians. And therefore, he has laid out what the Palestinians, in a sense, are going to be getting. Who's going to stand up for the Palestinians to prevent that from happening?
Well, there is a resistance that exists across the Middle East. The resistance has been showing its teeth and its force and has, in fact, defeated the imperialist incursions into the Middle East, across Syria, across several other regions, whether it's Lebanon, whether it's in Iraq. We've seen that the imperialists haven't had their way. They're not getting their own way. And this actually is a state of desperation we see, especially the United States and Israel, in at the moment. The fact that they've had to play this card is really interesting, because the first thing you've got to remember is that the Palestinians must have their right to return. Those lands are occupied. They've been illegally occupied under no form of justice, no law, no sense of moral standard can anybody justify the complete eradication of the Palestinians who've had to be forced out of the land that they call Israel. That is Palestine. The reality is it is an occupied territory. Now, what are the provisions that Donald Trump and his cohort are going to make for the right of return of Palestine? That's the fundamental issue. Now, the two-state solution, which is a joke anyway and has been a joke for a very long time, if we look through the smoke screens that are being thrown up, what's actually happening is that the U.S. is playing a game. Basically, they're saying, okay, we could go really all out and go on Israel's side completely. Now you Palestinians better behave yourselves and take what you're given. And what you're given is a few scraps of land outside of around Gaza or beyond. And the rest of it is basically, we want you to admit and acknowledge that Israel is a legitimate entity. That in itself is a game which actually the Palestinians should be resisting, because what it does is it denies them the right of return. That's what the American game is here. That's what the Israeli game is. And I think that the whole of the resistance movement and the Arab world should wake up to the fact that this is a very devious and cunning game, that the two-state solution is no solution in reality. What it is giving Palestinians a few scraps of land, with Gaza being the biggest open-air prison with no real economic ability to function in any way. And Israel wants control of that. And if you think that Israel would genuinely allow the Palestinians the freedom without a struggle, then I think that I'm afraid we're all living in cuckoo land.
Nabil Mikhail, the three things that Iran's leader has said that are vital is in the Palestinian issue are land occupation. You got the mass expulsion of millions of people and the massacre and horrible crime against humanity that's occurred. Iran's leader has stated that, and he said that these acts of oppression have never happened against any other nation to this degree. You talked about the international community, Nabil Mikhail, that the PA is reaching out to. What international community and what partners can he find when this hasn't happened in the past decades?
That's a very good question, and it will require actually a lengthy debate, but the challenge is to be brief. As I said, there is a consensus that there should be a Palestinian state. So let us ask the international community members, who supports this consensus? What kind of vision do you have for a Palestinian state? Because what happened is that the West Bank, for instance, is a constellation of cities that are rooted in history. So you cannot really eradicate that sense of identity. I mean, what is the whole concept or rationale of a Palestinian nationalism? Is that they used to be part of Greater Syria, Arabs living in a land called historically Palestine. But after 1948, they became Palestinians living in an Arab land. So there is a big identity transformation here. And that should boost their effort to get international recognition. Right after the Jerusalem resolution, the French President Macron invited the Palestinian leadership. So France could be an entry for Europe, but also you have Russia with a heavy and what I call a long-term presence in the Middle East. That could be also a factor. So you have so many factors, and you have actually in Jerusalem many Christian churches and Christian communities who want the holy city to be shared by other faiths. So you have actually a momentum. And I think if you apply smart diplomacy, you can redeem the Palestinians.
Well, one of the sides of this so-called peace push, for lack of a better word, that I'm going to ask you, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, has been Saudi Arabia. Tell us the role that the U.S. is trying to have it play, have Saudi Arabia play, because we're seeing Saudi Arabia being one of the major influencers of how this is going to take shape. We've heard about the visits by Mahmoud Abbas to Saudi Arabia, and then, of course, this meeting, this recognition that took place. It's still pressure being exerted by Saudi Arabia on Mahmoud Abbas to accept this recognition of Al-Quds. But why should Saudi Arabia at this point be the flag bearer of this peace process when they have not done anything in the past, and it is said that they're going to actually stab the Palestinians in the back?
Well, the reality is that Saudi Arabia is partisan. They are the proxy of the U.S. They are the proxy of Israel, in reality, as well. The Haramain has been occupied as well. We talk about occupied Palestine and Al-Quds, but let's look at the occupation of the Haramain. Medina and Mecca have been under occupation of a proxy Zionist agency known as the Wahhabists. And in fact, effectively, what you've got is those Wahhabists are being told to come in and lead everybody to some sort of promised land of peace. They're not doing that. What they're doing is subtly bullying, just as they did with Hariri. They're going around bullying people, just as they're doing in Yemen, just as they're doing in Bahrain, just as they tried to do in Syria, as they tried to do in Iraq. They are the fundamental divisive agency on the ground to allow Israel not to come to the front line. Because if Israel came to the front line, it would be an open war between Arabs and the Israeli entity. But by using Saudi Arabia and using it their proxies, it makes them continue the strategy that they've been employing for a very, very long time, which is divide and rule. Something the British left behind as a legacy a long time ago. But divide and rule works like this. What you do is you buy off one agency within the Arabs and you make them do exactly what you want, and you do everything to divide that region on Sunni Shia grounds, you divide them on Arab Persian grounds, you divide them on national tribal grounds, and what you need ultimately is a dictator at the heart of it. And what we've got is King Salman and his son are effectively now operating an even harsher dictatorship than the clan that ran things before. This is all at the behest of the Zionists, it's at the behest of the money lenders, it's at the behest of the Americans. That whole force, which wants to basically secure the geopolitical region in its own interests, they want to secure the economy of that region in their own interests, they want to retain Israel as a landing trip for all sorts of military hardware that they want to ultimately use in the Middle East, and as an access for creating what is known as fitna in Arabic, it's conflict. The whole purpose of Israel is to continue the conflict, to make sure that the Arab world doesn't stand up on its own two feet. The Arabs, Saudi Arabia's track record is that they have $3 trillion invested in U.S. Real estate or in assets in the U.S. This is the kind of Arab government you're looking at, or the Arab sort of regime you're looking at. And you're asking them to administer justice. They've never spent a penny on Palestinian injustice. And let's take it a little further. Because the other proxies which have been handed over by Israel and by America to the Saudis was that the mission of establishing ISIS, Jabhat al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda, all of these proxy terror agencies that have been operating in the Middle East and around the world, financed by these Arab so-called philanthropists in the background. In fact, it's the Arab establishment. It's the Saudi Arabian establishment. Tell me this. Has any of those groups ever fought for the Palestinian cause? Has ISIS, has Al-Qaeda, all proxies of Saudi Arabia, have they ever fired a shot in anger? Have they ever put a token of peace towards the Palestinian children? There are over 1,500 Palestinian children that have been imprisoned last year, out of which 500 are still in prisons. They're tortured, they're abused, many are raped. These are official statistics from the UN, which I'm quoting. So Israel is torturing children in Palestine at the same time as its friends, the Saudi Arabians and the Americans, are talking about involving them in creating a peace for Palestinians. What nonsense.
Well, Nabil Mikhail, you heard our guest there. If you have a response to him, even though he talked about different facts or details as he sees it regarding Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, look, the Palestinian question is older than many of the alliances America struck with many Arab countries in the Middle East. Like, for instance, 4 years ago, when Egypt started talking to the Israelis directly, it was a two-track diplomacy to get America to rectify the situation between Egypt and Israel, and asks Israel to return to Sinai, and that happened, and also to pursue what began as a self-autonomy talks which failed for the Palestinians. So there are many diplomatic avenues to explore, but what I am thinking about now, even from the standpoint of the American national interest, America's positions now are endangering America's security, because there could be a great deal of terror directed against America and American targets as a result of the current policies America is applying in the Middle East and toward the Palestinians. So basically, America here risks a great deal of antagonism on the part of the Arabs, the Palestinians, the Muslims, and many countries because of its policy in the Middle East.
Great. Well,
so the question is...
We've ran out of time. We've ran out of time for this. I'd like to give our guest, Sayyid Amosan Abbas, in closing, 30 seconds. And I saw you shaking your head when our guest, Nabil Mikhail, was talking. Go ahead.
A snake is always a snake. A leopard doesn't change its spots. If you're going to tell us to trust the Americans and trust the Israelis and trust the Saudi Arabians to negotiate a peaceful peace deal for the Palestinians, then we really are the most politically stupid people on this planet. The reality is that you can't trust these people. Bottom line is they are working in tandem to create a good cop, bad cop scenario in which they want to trap the Palestinians into thinking there is no other solution, that these diplomatic solutions of having scraps of land which are acceptable, a two-state solution will be made acceptable, the idea that of right of return is cancelled. Israel solves its problem because they know if they allow the Palestinians back into their rightful territory, even if they don't have to kick out all the Zionists, the truth is that the population of the Arabs will rise to the point where in a democracy or a democratic Israel or a democratic Palestine, more to the point, they would all automatically become insignificant. They cannot afford for that to happen. They don't want a one-state solution. They don't want right of return for Palestinians. There will be no solution, according to Donald Trump and Americans, which is going to be fair for Palestine. They should reject it and they should resist in any way and mean that they can, other than actually capitulating to these people's devious, cunning tactics.
Thank you. We unfortunately got to end it. Thank you so much.